Our midday special on poverty capitalism continues with a look at how some laws, government policies, and business practices leave low-income Marylanders vulnerable to all kinds of problems. Look at Baltimore's property tax system, how it puts some low-income homeowners at risk of losing their houses. Plus, rent-to-own stores and payday loans, while sought after by those who can't get credit or afford upfront costs. These practices hide exorbitant interest rates that overwhelm consumers. And finally, a look at tip wage workers. Maryland will raise its minimum wage to $10.10 an hour by 2018. But tipped wage workers have been left behind, making under $4 an hour and relying on customers to make up the difference. Their advocates say it's never been more expensive to be poor. Our look at poverty capitalism continues after the news. And welcome back to Midday Special on Poverty Capitalism. The second hour of our show today, we continue our discussion on how expensive it is to be poor with a look at homeowners, consumers, and workers in Maryland. Michael Reich joining us again for this hour from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. You know, in a way, I said this at the beginning of the first hour, Michael, I've been hearing this for years. You know, when I first came to Baltimore and started knocking around as a reporter, people would say the only food available in a certain neighborhood, a low-income neighborhood, was a corner convenience store, and a can of string beans there costs, you know, twice what it would at the Giant in Towson. Cab service, you have to pay for a sedan or somebody to drive you someplace because you don't own a car. You can't get to the bus on time or something like that. So this has always been sort of a theme in Baltimore. In certain neighborhoods, in the low-income neighborhoods.
I think it's true in many large cities as well. When I was working in Detroit before I came back to Baltimore, there was one or two grocery stores in a city that at the time had a population of over 900,000. So, you know, it's all pervasive. I mean, we talk about it in specific areas like, you know, credit or housing or childcare or healthcare or the criminal justice system, as we were doing. But I think the situation for people who are in poverty is it's all pervasive. There's no escape. Every aspect of their life is affected by these discriminatory practices, these exploitive practices. And so everything compounds each other. One of the things that's striking for me is that, and I was reading some of the material in preparation for this program, is that in the 1930s, when we had a depression that affected people who had not been poor before, there was a lot more compassion for people who had been poor. But it's ironic that since 2007, 2008, in the Great Recession, where something similar happened, we haven't seen a similar response. That people who may be suffering because they lost their jobs and they're no longer holding on to middle class status are not showing more compassion for the poor. In fact, the demonization and the exploitation of the poor, particularly poor people of color, is getting even worse. And I think we have to examine why that's going on.
There is a disconnect. We talked about this before on the show. I don't quite understand it. But because there seem to be more people who were in the middle before who have fallen down lower on the scale, while we've had this concentration of wealth at the top that we've talked about on other programs.
Yeah.
So why they don't identify more with people who are the working poor, by the way. Most of the poor that we talk about in the United States are employed, right?
And why they're not sympathetic to the way that they get exploited by predatory lenders and the whole, rent to own programs that we'll talk about
in this hour. Up front, we're going to talk about something that came on our radar just this past week because of the Able Foundation, an Able Foundation report on Baltimore City tax sales, how homeowners can lose their house and all of its equity over just $250 in unpaid taxes. We're going to talk about that. We'll also talk about rent-to-own and payday loans. But first, Susan Francis is with us, Deputy Director of the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Service. It's a terrific organization. The Able Foundation, another terrific organization, published this report, The Steep Price of Paying to Stay, a study of the tax sales system in Baltimore City. And the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Service collected data for the report from legal clinics for homeowners facing tax sales. So, Susan, nice to have you with us. Susan Francis.
Thank you. Let's talk about this a little bit. So you have a homeowner in Baltimore City, and what? And someone will say, what, they can't pay $250? How does this happen when people can actually lose their homes in a sale to, speculators who come in and buy these things for as little as $250 owed to the city?
Well, you know, the tax sale is a little bit of a misnomer in that when you hear tax sale, you think someone didn't pay their property tax. But it's actually a combination of a couple of issues that can bring someone into a tax sale. It's an unpaid water bill. It can be a property tax. It also can be a variety of other citations from the city. Essentially, if an individual has a dollar in delinquent property tax and have citations because they, you know, maybe didn't clean up garbage around their property, that can also put them into tax sale. So there's a variety of ways folks can end up in tax sale. I don't think most Baltimore City residents would understand that they might lose their house because of an unpaid water bill or, you know, a not mowing your yard kind of bill. And then, you know, there's some notice issues with individuals being able to
notice issues
from knowing that they actually are going to be put in tax sale. So there's a combination of factors. It's also individuals, if once they've went into tax sale, it's very, very difficult for them to afford to redeem it. But there is also, we have lots of low-income homeowners in Baltimore City. And so when you get behind because you've lost your job, or many of our folks are senior citizens or disabled, they're living on a limited income. We have a reality right now. I think BG&E just yesterday announced that their utility rates are going to go up again. Our water bill rates since 2012 are going up 44%. And so we're putting quite a squeeze on our low-income homeowners. You add to that, you know, a leaky roof, a car repair, and most of these folks are really struggling to pay these bills.
Would you say African-Americans, senior citizens, you said disabilities, people with disabilities, are disproportionately affected by this system, the tax sale system? Is that true, or are they just people who are just scofflaws.
No.
Just don't want tax evaders.
That's absolutely true. My organization both provides legal representation for these individuals, but we also attend these legal clinics. And so I've seen it firsthand where it is absolutely the African-American community is disproportionately affected. And all of our folks that are on fixed income are definitely affected, folks that are disabled.
Talk for a minute, would you please, about third-party investors? The city puts a lien on a property, right, because of unpaid taxes. These investors buy the tax lien certificates. Is that how it works?
That's right. So if you have either a $250 property tax bill or $350 and three quarters delinquent, meaning you're 9 months behind, then it goes to tax sale in May. And what happens is it's quite a big business where there are these tax sale purchasers that come in, purchase these tax sale liens. And from that point, for someone to redeem it, they have to pay that lien amount. They have to pay the interest that was accruing that entire time it was delinquent.
Excuse me, if I want to keep my house.
Absolutely. And
okay,
then,
I owe this money. The lien certificate's been sold to this speculator investor.
Right.
And then he or she will charge me interest to stay in the house?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Interest on the debt.
Right. So what happens is as soon as you start becoming delinquent, you start accruing 3% interest right off the get-go. Once it's sold and tax sale, the tax sale certificate purchaser, the investor, gets 18% interest. So in order for you to redeem the property, you have to pay the original lien that you owed, any interest or penalties that you accrued prior to it going to tax sale, and then that 18% interest. And that's only up until 4 months. At 4 months, you start adding additional fees on top of it. I actually brought you an example from one of our actual clients. Her lien was about $1,900. And by the time she was done with
The sale,
the attorney's fees, all the miscellaneous fees that go on top of it, it was over $5,000.
Now, excuse me, I need to ask the next thing. Well, go ahead, Michael.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't understand about this. If a homeowner owes money to the city and is delinquent in paying the taxes, I can understand the city then, you know, adding a interest or fine if you don't pay your taxes. But when the city then sells that lien to a private person,
third party,
and that person increases the interest rate without the consent of the original homeowner, how can they do that? I mean, there's a quasi contract being created between this private third party and the original homeowner without the homeowner's consent. I don't understand how that's legal.
Does Michael have that right?
That is right.
That seems to be unconstitutional.
Yeah. Well, that was my reaction when I first learned about it
as well. 18%. I mean, so my next question was going to be, okay, so this lady that you were telling us about, she owes $5,000 on an original arrears of $1,900.
Right.
What if she can't pay it? Then what happens?
Well, in this particular scenario, we had an attorney that helped her work out a payment plan with the tax. However, she's got to pay 8% on top of that as part of her repayment on this payment plan to keep her house. But why I'm here and what we're most concerned about is if they don't redeem the property, they lose the property and they lose every bit of equity in the property. So literally someone can walk away from their house over a $250 tax bill. And many of our folks have their houses paid for. We're talking about senior citizens that work their whole life to pay off their home.
In the Able report, there's reference to an 80-year-old gentleman, a man who was 80 years old, and his house was paid off. He'd been in this house for 50 years. He fell behind due to, I guess it was medical bills, right? You remember him?
Yeah.
And then the house went to tax sale, but he managed to pull out of it with a loan of some kind.
There is a small loan program through the Neighborhood Housing Services for individuals to up to a certain amount that they can borrow it and then pay it back. So we have a few folks that were able to save their properties, but most of our individuals cannot.
Here's an important question. So $250, if you're in arrears, $250 to the city, that's when they can hit you with a lien?
Yes.
At that level?
Yep.
So the question is, why is it so low? Because apparently in other jurisdictions, it's not that low, right?
Right. It's not that low. And the one other thing I would just add to that is there's also no different treatment between a vacant property and an owner-occupied property. Mm. So, we certainly can see the need to perhaps move vacant property a little bit faster so that the community can reinvest in it. But they're all treated the same. So we have owner-occupied properties where, yes, they are losing it for $250.
Going back to Michael Reich's point, though, I want to go back to what you were saying before and the scenario that Susan has described. This third party becomes the tax collector. Am I right?
Yes.
Wouldn't you say the de facto tax collector?
Yeah, and it gets a little bit trickier than that.
Assuming the role of the city.
They do. And there are some notice issues. We have some tax sale certificate holders that are not doing a very good job letting the homeowners know how much they owe because it keeps changing because of the interest, so folks can have difficulty redeeming their property. We also have many of our tax sale certificate holders are also attorneys, so they're charging their own attorney's fees for their own purchases on top of it. So it just becomes this multi-layering of, significant profit for the tax sale purchaser, either through all of those fees and interest or taking the property at the price of, our folks losing their homes.
Can I read you a quote from an article that was written 43 years ago by Herbert Gans?
Yes.
I cited it before, The Uses of Poverty. Among the functions of poverty, he wrote, "The poor also aid the upward mobility of groups above them in the class hierarchy. That is, Americans have entered the middle class through the profits earned from the provision of goods and services in the slums." And what you're describing is that people are just making money off of people who are in incredibly vulnerable situations. So
we have scenarios. I want to ask you if this is real, that elderly people or whoever it is, that they hit that $250 threshold, it goes to tax sale. Whatever interest is owed, they can't pay the full amount. It goes to foreclosure. So these people actually lose their house. The third party individual who entered this picture and purchased the tax lien certificates, they stay in the picture because they want this property. They want to flip it, right?
Generally. So which leads to a whole nother issue. So the homeowner loses their home, every bit of equity is gone. So you could have, say, $100,000 property that's gone for $250. So that's a problem. But then there's also with these tax sale purchasers, either they flip it or they just neglect it. They just walk away from it. And now we have no one else can come in and try to maintain the property and, you know, keep the community vibrant. And they're what we call ghost properties. And so that's also an issue.
We'll make sure we put the Able Foundation report written by Joan Jacobson on my Facebook page, and maybe on the, we should get it on the WYPR website as well. It's called The Steep Price of Paying to Stay, a look at the Baltimore City tax sale system by the Able Foundation with the help of the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Service. And Susan Francis is the deputy director, has been speaking with us about that. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And we'll take another break here. Dan Rodericks with Michael Reich. We'll continue our conversation about poverty capitalism, a look at some shady practices by businesses that target the poor, rent-to-own stores, payday lenders, all that coming up after this short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. You know, you might have a case there. I think I heard you suggesting that that whole system be tested in court. It sounds like it's ripe for that.
I don't remember enough of my contracts class to know whether that's illegal, but it seems like there's something fishy about it.
Yeah, something wrong with that. There's certainly something wrong with a threshold of $250 in tax arrears.
That's a political policy issue, but the other one more is a legal issue. Could the nature of a contract be changed,
transferred
unilaterally,
or created without another party agreeing to it? That's a good question. We're going to turn now to some other practices that fall under the title of this program, Poverty Capitalism, Rent-to-Own and Payday Loan Industries. I want to mention a recent Washington Post article on this very subject, Rental America, Why the Poor Pay $4,150 for a $1,500 Sofa. It's a very good article. It was based on some reporting in Alabama by a Washington Post reporter. It followed a woman who purchased a couch from a rent-to-own store. She couldn't afford to pay $1,500 all at once, so she decided on a 2-year installment plan. Rent-to-own stores can charge unlimited interest rates, and purchases end up paying between 2 and 4 times the wholesale price of the item. The rent-to-own industry falls somewhere in between a loan and a purchase, which makes it easier for this practice to go unregulated. And the article examined why somebody would do that, you know, why someone would make a decision to purchase or rent to purchase a sofa like that. It was very interesting. We wanted to talk about this practice in Maryland. Marceline White is joining us again here on Midday. She's executive director of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition, which has worked on this issue. And we have talked about this in the past on Midday. Nice to see you again, Marceline.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
So it seems to me like, to refresh my memory, but a couple of years ago, there was some legislation in Annapolis. I remember Delegate Mary Washington, I think, involved in this, trying to address the rent-to-own industry in Maryland. Could you refresh your memory on that?
Absolutely. So Delegate Washington has been very concerned about this issue and really wanted to draft legislation that would place some reasonable limits on the rent-to-own industry in Maryland. And we did research at that time looking at exactly what was happening to Maryland families who were trying to purchase rent-to-own televisions, refrigerators, et cetera. What we found is that in Maryland, people are paying between 2 to 3.5 times more for an item than they would if they were able to go to a traditional store like a Walmart. And in general, they were paying $1,000 more for a refrigerator. And, you know, this is not a high-end refrigerator. This is a basic refrigerator. So, again, it's another example of how the industry captures people who don't have a lot of options and really gouges them and makes them pay a lot more than they would if they had other alternatives.
So did the legislation require them to report what the total cost would be?
It required them to report what the total cost would be. It required them to be able to rescind, to change their mind, which Maryland has in some other cases where you have 3 days and you can go back and change your mind. It established clearer contract rules because the language was very unclear. And it capped the payments so that no matter what, you wouldn't be paying more than 2 times the wholesale cost.
Okay.
But so it did not pass.
It didn't pass.
It did not pass.
We should add that.
Let's be clear.
Yeah. Has she gone back with this and you in your group?
What did pass was a narrower form to improve the contract and to improve the disclosures. But that is all we were able to pass at that time. So I think it's something we're both still very concerned about. I think, from my perspective, the best thing to do would be to try to get a court decision. The places that have been able to really resolve this have had the courts rule that these are not leases. People aren't leasing these and turning them back in. What they're trying to do is buy them, and it should be treated the same way as any other credit transaction. If that were to happen, then our state rental caps or our usury caps would fall into place, and people couldn't charge more than 36%. Right now, we're seeing 305% interest rates on these kinds
of
items.
Say that again.
305% interest rates on these kinds of caps, on these kinds of items. So it's outrageous.
I mean, it's kind of
like loan sharking.
Abby, I mean,
absolutely.
I want to throw something in here. In the Washington Post, you read the Washington Post piece?
I did. Excellent piece.
Yeah. And it explored why somebody would do something like this. Because a lot of people sit out here and they hear these stories or they read that story in the Post and they say, what is wrong with the customer? I understand you're poor. I understand you don't have cash. I understand you don't have credit. But, you know, go to a Goodwill. Do what I did in college. You know, go to a secondhand store. Go on Craigslist. Figure something else out. You don't need a $1,500 couch. Let's just talk about that a little bit. People have been pretty harsh in their judgments about the couple depicted in that Washington Post story. And you hear these comments whenever the conversation turns to the plight of the poor.
Sure. I think people can always be very harsh when they haven't walked a mile in the other person's shoes. But I think one of the issues you have to look at is that these rent-to-own stores make it very easy and appealing to the customer. They are in Baltimore City, 93% of the stores are in disproportionately low-income neighborhoods. So it's much easier if you don't have good transportation to get to a rent-to-own store than it is to go out on Craigslist. Maybe you have a computer, maybe you don't. To go on Craigslist, find a place, get transportation, and move the item back. And they're designed to appeal to consumers and make it seem as if it's easy without factoring in the long-term cost. I think that's one issue. The other issue is that for a lot of places, you need something like a computer or something that's harder to find on a Craigslist, and you may need it now. Or you may need the refrigerator today, and you don't have the $300 for the refrigerator, but you have the $30. And that's part of the issue. It's a liquidity issue. They may not have the money to buy something outright, but there are items they need to buy today because the refrigerator broke, and they can pay the $30 or $50.
Right. There's something in there to explain it. I mean, thrift stores are not the solution for everything. People think they are. But, Michael Rice, I turn to you here because I read comment after comment on social media. The Post, as they do with a lot of their stories, posted this story on their Facebook page too, so you could read even more comments, and they were pretty harsh in their judgment of these people who bought the couple depicted in that story who did this down in Alabama. By the way, the store that they purchased it from apparently is expanding at the rate of one retail outlet per week as a rent to own.
Well, this is reminiscent of a conversation I had with a bunch of state legislators a number of years ago when I was going over the budget of people who are on public assistance or welfare. They were wondering, well, we've heard stories about, you know, mothers on welfare buying their kids Air Jordans or fancy sneakers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's true. But if you talk to these mothers, as I have and as other researchers have, the social pressure to do that is so great. It's analogous to the situation going on where people are blaming all the people whose mortgages are underwater because they were suckered in by salespeople who were selling predatory loans. We live in a society in which one's value is equated with the possession of certain consumer goods. Everyone wants to own a home. It's the American dream. Everyone wants their kids to have the right shoes or clothes in school. Everyone wants their living space, however modest, to look attractive. And, you know, we live in an environment in which advertising and consumption are hitting us all the time. Why do we expect low-income people to be less susceptible to that than anyone else?
Marceline, how many rent-to-own stores are in Maryland? Do we know now?
There are several hundred, and I know when we looked at it a few years ago, they were making $67 million a year in Maryland alone. So that's a lot of money profiting off of low-income people.
Have you noticed if there are more stores?
They're increasing.
I wonder, coming out of this recession or during the recession, there were more of these stores.
I know the Rent-A-Center and Aaron's were both on a growth trajectory and saw their businesses increasing. Again, as another sign of the economic recession, people have less money to spend and less liquidity, you know, less money in their pockets, so they're looking at things like rent-to-own.
Our phone number here for Midday, by the way, is 410-662-8780. We welcome calls on any of the topics that we're addressing during this hour, our second hour, on the subject of poverty, capitalism, and the high price of being poor. 866-661-9309. I don't know where the 800 came from. Sorry about that. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. Marceline White, Executive Director of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition. So what's the answer here? I know I heard what you described what you've tried in the legislature, and I guess you can go back and try that again. But it seems to me public education, consumer information to people who are in the market for furniture, for one thing, or appliances would be really important. How do you get the message out?
I think that's a great question. I think there's been research saying two things. One, you have to do consumer education before people are walking in the door of the Rent-A-Center. So you have to be able to partner with places of worship, for example, or senior centers or others to do that kind of education and get the information out so people understand the real cost and the real dangers of what happens when they make that kinds of when they make that kind of rent-to-own transaction. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, when they're trying to lease a rent-to-own item, if they miss a payment, the item can be repossessed, and all of the payments they've made towards it are gone. So people need to understand the consequences and what the real costs are of these items. The other issue is to have clear contracts. We've seen that in the National Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where they redesigned the mortgage disclosure forms. If you understand what you're signing, it's much easier for you to make an informed decision. But it's been in the interest of a lot of people in these industries to make it as confusing as possible so you don't understand the real cost.
The other subject I wanted to address with you is payday loans. These loans are a Band-Aid used by millions of Americans that need money fast. And why don't you describe for folks who the uninitiated how payday loans work?
Sure. So a payday loan is a loan that someone would take out basically to get them over a hump. It's called till their next payday. And it's a short-term loan of between $300 to $1,000 or so dollars. And what they can do is they can take it out at a store or online. But the interest rates on these loans range from, 100% to 1,100% for the short-term loan. And now the industry would say, well, that's only $50 or that's only $100 for our loan. But if someone can't make it from one payday to the next, there's no way they're going to be able to make it to the next payday and have the additional $100 to pay off the loan. So what we see is that people take out one loan and then they'll come back 2 weeks later, not have enough money, have to take out a second loan to cover the cost of the first loan and extend their loan. And nationally, what we're seeing is that people are taking out at least six of these loans over the course of a year before they can try to do something to get out of it. So we really see it as a debt trap. People look to it as a lifeline and an answer, but it really is a debt trap, and it keeps them weighed down with these, these loan sharking kinds of rates. And
who's extending the loans? Are these banks?
These are primarily payday lending stores or online operators.
Okay, so banks aren't generally involved in this.
Banks have been criticized by advocates for getting involved in small loans that have some of the characteristics of payday loans. In Maryland, they haven't done that as much. The good news is that Maryland has a 36% rate cap on small loans. So there aren't a lot of payday lending stores in Maryland.
There used to be. Yeah, I used to see more of those.
There used to be more.
Have they all been shut down?
They've been shut down, but the issue that still happens is online. Because, of course, with the internet, everyone can go online and people are borrowing. And they estimate that at least 3% of Marylanders are still taking out payday loans with interest rates of up to 1,100%. So it's still a problem for Maryland, even though we've tried to hold it down with low cost or reasonable interest rates.
So Maryland has taken some action then.
They have.
To ban the storefronts.
They have. And we've closed loopholes. We were involved in a fight in the assembly in 2010 with former Commissioner of Financial Regulation Sarah Bloom Raskin to close a loophole that they were trying to use to enter the state again. So Maryland's been very good, and our former Commissioner Mark Kaufman fought off some of the lending where people argued that because they were Native American, they were sovereign, and rules wouldn't apply to them because they were governed by sovereign nation rules, and we fought off those. But the issue is that we're still having Marylanders receive these loans. They get about 250 to 300 complaints a year in Maryland at the Commissioner of Financial Regulation's office. So it's still a problem.
Okay, it's still a problem. Even at that extent, you said 3% are doing it, but the high interest rate. I mean, doesn't don't we have a division of financial regulation in Maryland?
And they go after them. And that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
They've been very vigorous. Mark Kaufman, who's the former commissioner, was vigorous about enforcing and sending cease and desist letters. They've been very good. But because people are doing it online, they only know if someone comes and complains to them.
Right.
And so one of the things that's happening right now is nationally, there's legislation that's been introduced to cap payday lending across the country at 36%. And so we've been working to get our Maryland delegation involved in that fight and supporting that bill.
Thank you, Marceline, for being here. People get desperate. You talk about a vicious cycle, Michael.
Yeah, you mentioned before about a liquidity or a credit trap. There's a potentially radical solution, which in these political times would not probably fly. And it wouldn't, try to change the culture in terms of people wanting to consume. What if the state set up a small loan fund and charged interest rates that were maybe twice or even three times the rate of inflation? So it would pay its own cost. It would probably stimulate more consumption because people would be able to actually buy things rather than rent to loan. And it would drive all of these corrupt practices out of business.
And they would be for people of a certain income level.
Right. Certain income level. Yeah. So it couldn't be like a wealthy person getting a loan.
No.
So that if that woman wanted to buy that couch, she could buy it and pay 5 or 6% interest. And the state may, some of these loans may not get paid off. But if enough people paid them and paid the interest rate, it would probably pay for itself.
No, I think something like that is a great idea. There have been some credit unions and also NHS, Neighborhood Housing Services, who have issued some pilot projects for small loans for people of certain income eligibility requirements as a counter, as an alternative to these kinds of payday loan traps. The challenge, of course, is getting the word out to enough people. And, of course, anyone who watches late night TV sees all of the ads that the industry puts out. So, the credit unions and, one organization have a hard time trying to rise above the fray.
Marceline White is Executive Director of the Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition. Thanks for coming in today, Marceline.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, nice to have you back with us. Michael Reich is with us. We're going to take one more break, and we'll address another subject coming up in the next segment of Midday. Since 2009, Maryland's tipped wage workers have earned $3.63 per hour, 50% of the state's current minimum wage. These workers rely on consumers to make up the difference. But why are their wages subject to the kindness of strangers? And what unique challenges do tipped wage workers face? We'll deal with that in the next segment of Midday. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work as we continue our conversation here about poverty capitalism, companies that profit off of the poor, and policies, government policies and laws that put the poor at a disadvantage. Here we wanted to talk about the minimum wage and tipped wage workers. Kathleen Algier-Fedarsik is joining us. She's a policy analyst for the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group. Nice to have you with us, Kathleen.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, this is a subject I wanted to address here today, Michael, because Maryland passed a minimum wage increase this past session of the General Assembly. It goes up to $10.10 per hour by 2018. So we're taking 4 years to get there, but at least they're doing that. But I've always been struck by this other tier that we have for tipped wage workers. In Maryland, it's, $3.63 per hour, right, Kathleen?
Yes, it is.
And is it scheduled to go up
as the minimum wage goes up over the next 4 years?
It is not. When they chose to raise the minimum wage in the last session, they actually chose to freeze the subminimum wage or the tipped base wage.
Okay, subminimum, we'll call it that, or tipped base wage.
Yes.
Now, the federal tipped base wage is $2.13 per hour,
yes.
Correct? Okay. So, and Maryland's is a little higher.
It's a little bit higher because we chose to keep it at 50% of our minimum wage up until this last session.
Okay. So, pardon me for bringing up this subject, folks, because a lot of people out there just assume, well, this is the way we've always done business in Maryland. That if you're a restaurant worker, you work for tips, and the guy that owns that restaurant doesn't have to pay you the minimum wage. He pays you a lot less. First of all, I don't know if everybody's aware of this. A lot of people are aware of this, especially people who worked as waiters and waitresses. They are well aware of this. But why do we have this system? That's my question. Is what lobbyists pulled this off? That's my question. Why do we have this two-tier
system? Well, if you listen to the testimony that I heard last spring in the General Assembly, it's the lobbyists for the restaurant industry and for many of the summer tourism industries. They were arguing that if we raise the tip wage any proportion, that it would drive a lot of these businesses out of business, that they couldn't afford their workforce. Is that right, Kathleen?
Yeah, so that's what has been reported. But there are actually 7 states in the U.S. that no longer have a tipped wage. They just have one minimum wage for all employees. And in those 7 states, you don't see that impact on the businesses. You don't see a loss of jobs. You see either no impact or minimal impact.
So did those states that did away with it, they have a one minimum wage for everybody, no matter where you work,
exactly.
Right? So this is a little philosophical, but the part I didn't understand was, so you get tips, so what? That's a good thing. That's an incentive for a waiter or waitress to be more pleasing to the customers, right? Instead, we have a system in Maryland and in most states where you're guaranteed a minimum. Your employer has to guarantee that you hit, $7.25 and then eventually $10.10 per hour. But your base pay is still only $3.63 an hour, right?
Right. So that's what is supposed to happen. You're supposed to make up the difference in tips. But actually, for a lot of tipped employees, that isn't what we see happening. Instead, what we're finding is that they don't get that difference. They don't make up the tips. Their employer is not paying them. You know, tips are very subjective. They vary according to workplace. They vary according to season. There's a recent study that came out that talked about how for female tipped wage workers, you know, their tips are linked to customers' perception of attractiveness. And so there's no guarantee. So that $3.63 base wage, it's too low of a wage for Maryland workers.
Well, I looked into this a little bit, too. Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of our favorite resources for information, last year did an analysis of this and found that the median hourly wage of a waiter, a waitress, worked out to $8.92 per hour. That's above the federal minimum, but still only about $18,500 a year. So it works out to $8.92 for everybody.
But still less than what the non-tipped workers are making per hour.
Still less than what non... Yes,
right.
So I don't know. Everybody just kind of accepts this system as the way it is, and the people who own restaurants depend on the kindness of strangers, of the customers, to fill in the difference, right?
I mean, if you think about it, someone who's working at a McDonald's who will get the minimum wage as it will increase doesn't necessarily have to be particularly friendly to the customers as long as they're efficient.
Right.
And they don't.
That's what that is.
And they
that's
don't take,
what that says.
And they don't take money out of the cash register.
Right.
But someone who's working at, say, another chain restaurant, though, who's a server, has to have a certain amount of service civility in order to count on even a relatively modest tip to bring his or her wages up to the minimum wage. It's a kind of a crazy system.
It was, and we established a federal minimum wage in the United States in 1938, but they didn't establish this separate base wage for tipped workers until the 1960s. I mean, I'm raising it here because I think there's something wrong with this. Do you think there's something wrong with this? Has your organization made a conclusion about this?
We absolutely think that there's something wrong with this. The base wage being as low as it is at $3.63 an hour is too low for these employees to support themselves, their families, or participate in Maryland's economy. So it's not only hurting the worker, it's also hurting Maryland.
What do the numbers look like, Michael and Kathleen, when it comes to people making the minimum wage in the United States, generally speaking? Can we talk about that?
I mean, how many people?
Yeah, I mean, what does it look like?
I don't have that off the top of my head. Do you?
What about in Maryland?
I think when they were talking about raising the minimum wage last session, it was reported to be over 400,000 were going to see an increase in their wages.
That's just in Maryland.
And just in Maryland.
Just from making this change in the law.
Yes.
Up until 10 per hour. Can I ask my listeners, I'd like to know what you think of this two-tier system. Have you ever even thought about it? I know a lot of you probably worked as waiters and waitresses over the years, and you know how this system works. Do you think it was okay? Do you think it's fair? 410-662-8780 is our number. You can send us a quick email with a comment to midday@wypr.org. So the fact that it's still in place after all this time, is this owing to good lobbying by the restaurant owners in Annapolis, or the lack of a constituency to change the law?
I think a lot of people assume that servers get a significant amount of money in tips, and that they end up earning more than the regular minimum wage as a result of that. So they think that well, in order to maintain the profitability of the restaurants, why should this come out of the employer's pocket? It's another example of what we were talking about in the first half of the program in terms of cost shifting. So rather than the employer paying a reasonable wage to the servers, it's an expectation that it's actually added on to the customer's bill.
So what are your thoughts on that, Kathleen?
I agree. I think that it is something where people expect the customer to make up the difference. But I think that, you know, that's kind of shifting the focus of who's responsible for, you know, ensuring that that minimum wage. And, you know, servers, restaurant workers, tipped workers, they endure other, workplace hardships. Sexual harassment is more prominent when you are working for a tipped wage. You're less likely to have paid sick leave. And there was a study that showed majority of restaurant workers actually were utilizing SNAP, which meant that the people who were serving your food couldn't afford food.
We're actually getting food stamps.
Right.
And back to the sexual harassment, I mean, that's very interesting because it plays right into this, the effort to get tips out of people. Is that why?
Exactly. And so
It's connected to that?
Right. And it's more common for female tipped employees. And so they have to make a decision. Do I endure this sexual harassment and get a larger tip? Or do I stop it? Do I report it and possibly lose my tip, lose my shift? Lose my hours.
Let's take some calls on this because I'm curious about how other people feel about it. Perhaps you think it levels the playing field for the restaurant owners. I just wonder if anyone else sees it as a two-tier system that whose rationale doesn't seem to be very strong anymore. At least in my mind, it doesn't. But I can be persuaded the other way. Ali in Baltimore, go right ahead. Ali, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. All right. We don't have a great connection there. Let's go to another caller right away. We have shorter time here. So Chris, go right ahead. Chris, are you there?
Yes. You can hear me?
Yeah. Go ahead with your comment, please.
Well, I work for somewhat of a restaurant chain. It's four locations throughout Maryland. And we look at it as a joke when we get our checks. We bet with each other whether or not someone's going to get a check or it's going to say, this is not a check. So we make more of a betting game out of it because we know we're not getting anything from it.
Please explain. What do you mean? You're not going to get paid by your boss?
Well,
what do you mean?
No, we get every 2 weeks we get the check in, but we usually make enough in our tips that it eats away at our hourly. So we get within maybe a few dollars from our hourly check, or we get a check that says this is not a check.
Oh,
because
I see.
We made too much in tip income. So we usually end up betting on who will get the highest check, and we make a game out of it.
I want to understand that then. So the person you work for actually isn't paying you anything some weeks?
It's being reported on our income, but we're making enough in tips that the taxes are actually eating away at our hourly, so we don't get anything from these checks.
Okay. Now, what do you think about the idea of just making what's their minimum wage now? $7.25?
Yes.
In Maryland? If you made $7.25 plus tips, wouldn't that make you a happier Chris?
Oh, I would welcome it gladly. I mean, it would be nice to actually get a kickback of anywhere from $50 to $100 every 2 weeks instead of a check that just says this is not a check.
Do you understand the point I'm making here,
yeah,
Reich?
Sure.
You do?
You know, it's interesting also. I just got this report 2 days ago from Wider Opportunities for Women, which I think is it's a research organization and an advocacy. And it's particularly important because so many of the servers are women. And it says that for a single childless worker, say a single woman without children, she would need to earn $30,000 a year in wages to have economic security. That would calculate to about $577 a week. If you use the average that you gave of what an average restaurant worker makes, that comes to about $360 a week. That's a huge gap. So we're talking about an enormous gap that particularly affects women.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this doesn't even count the gap if these women had children.
Right.
And then it gets much, much higher than that.
Let's take another call on this. Jennifer, you're on Midday. Thank you for calling. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So basically, I think that this two-tiered system really has some significant challenges if it can't be enforced. And so, for example, I used to work in a restaurant in Ohio where the employer at times would use servers who are being paid $3.25 an hour to fulfill other duties within the restaurant, so cleaning the kitchen, bussing tables, whatever, that did not receive tips. So it cut down on the amount that on the payroll budget because they weren't having to pay people, you know, $5 or $7 an hour. But then the servers were not getting tips and the employers were not backfilling their checks to make sure they met minimum wage.
Wow.
So if this kind of system is in place and there's no regulation to ensure that employers are paying their employees properly, I think it's really a broken system.
Interesting. Any comment on that, Kathleen?
Yes, absolutely. That's something that is fairly common, and employees often don't speak up for fear of retaliation. They also have to tip out other employees using their own tips. When the U.S. Department of Labor, you know, they did a study to look at wage theft, they found that almost 85% of restaurants that they looked into had some type of wage and hour violation that included nearly $5.5 million in back wages. And tipped employees are also eligible for overtime pay, which a lot of times they don't realize and the employer doesn't credit to them.
Say that again. The tip wage employees eligible for overtime, but
right. But they either don't realize that they are eligible, and so they don't seek it from their employer,
oh, okay.
Or it's not given.
And they don't raise it because they don't want to cause trouble.
Right.
Right? Don't want to maybe lose their job. Do they talk about their hours? Do they have regular hours?
So that can be hard because it can be seasonal depending on where you're working.
Sure.
And so if it's a slow shift, they can get cut. And then, you know, it's a loss of hours. It's lots of income. When they have to stay home from work because they're sick, that's another chance for them to lose hours and lose their income. One tipped worker said, you know, if I'm out for a weekend, that's, you know, like my groceries. If I'm out for a week, that's my rent.
You know, what would happen if you changed this? I guess the restaurants would scream that they were going to lose business, right? Or that they would just have to pass along to customers and the costs would go up, or the menu costs.
Well, in most of the world, the charge for service is added onto the bill, whether it's 10%, 15%, 20%.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to, so waiters and waitresses don't have to worry about tips. And in those countries, being a server is a regular job. And sometimes they're even unionized and they get regular wages. And it's just factored into the cost of doing business. And it also takes away all this pressure about how much of a tip should I leave. If you want to leave a little bit extra, you can always do that. But it's just routinely added to the bill. And it sort of takes that whole issue out of the equation.
Michael Reich, thanks for being here today for these discussions. I really appreciate your input. And whenever we have you on our show, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be here.
Yep. Michael Reich, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, professor of social justice there, joins us from time to time here on Midday. And we have the company of Kathleen Allgaier-Fedarsik, who is policy analyst for the Maryland Center on Economic Policy, filling us in on the wage laws in Maryland. Thank you very much for being here, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our program today. We hope you enjoyed it and learned some things. And you'll come back again next week for another week of Midday here on WYPR. Have a great afternoon and a great weekend. We'll see you soon.